All right. If you missed the last, we had a class last week, even though I know a lot of people were away or on programs or not available, and so we had a slightly smaller class in attendance than we usually do. I understand that that was true for all of the Torah and Motion classes last week. The class was recorded, and so it is available on the both the Torah in Motion website and the Torah in Motion YouTube channel. If you have so if you missed that class, you might want to kind of pick that up or fill that in, because we're kind of finishing up one topic and then we're going to start a new topic. So you'll be able to fill in the gap. But essentially, where we were at when we at the end of the class last week was looking at the various reasons given. Somebody said, is there a source page for today? Yes, as soon as I share my screen, I will share the source page too. Although, actually, interesting, when I rebooted my computer, that shut down. Okay, hang on a second. Restore pages. There we go.
Is this a new short page?
Yes, this will be a new source page. Wait a minute. There you go. Okay. But we haven't gotten to it yet. So when we get to it, I will share it with you. But where we were at last week was we finished going through a number of different parts of the chapter of Crossing the Jordan, in which we have a description of why reasons that are given in the text for the need to cross the Jordan in such a dramatic fashion. We talked about the significant size of the wall of water. We talked about where it was located in terms of Adam Ha'ir, and we talked about these 12 stones that Yeshua instructs the people to take out of the bed of the Jordan River and to establish as a kind of a monument on the west bank of the Jordan River, whether that is in Gilgal initially, or whether that gets moved up to Shechem for the ceremony of Har Gerizim and Har Eival, and whether they're the same stones as the ones that are used later on in that ceremony, debated amongst the Mefarshim. But essentially, there is this almost an entire chapter devoted to the requirement for the leaders of the tribes of Israel, to each leader of each tribe, to take one of these stones, to take it from where the Kohanim stood, to bring it to the banks of the river, and to establish them in Gilgal. And that's how, and that's the mystery. What is the purpose of these stones? And the text tells us that the purpose of these stones is so that we can, much like in, well, actually, let me just show you that part of the text. So let's go into the share screen. All right, you should now be seeing our shared screen, yes? Yep. Okay. So, we'll get to the source page share. The source page will be needed for the second half of the share today. If we get there, I will share it with you. But in the end of chapter four, which is where we were, they take these stones, they put them in Gilgal, and, there we find, Bet 12 havanim ha'ela she lakhu min ha'yadein hekim Yeshua ba'Gilgal. Yeshua takes these 12 stones and he builds them into some kind of a structure or establishes them in Gilgal. And the fact that there are 12, I don't think is clearly not an accident. In fact, the heads of each tribe are told to take a stone, so the 12 tribes representing the 12 tribes of Israel, much as, and we saw this last week, Moshe builds 12 stones in Matseva, 12 monuments or 12 stones at the foot of Har Sinai to represent the unity of the tribes of Israel, separate from the Mizbeach that he builds in order to bring the offerings and the sacrifices after that were part of the Brit. And we find the same kind of 12 stones being used by Eliyahu and Har HaKarmel, where he makes a Mizbeach out of 12 stones and uses that to kind of unify the tribes of Israel. The significance of that, a message that does not escape us. And then, Vayomer b'nei Yisrael le'mor, asher yishalun b'nechem machar et avotam le'mor, maha avanim ha'ele. If your children will ask you tomorrow, saying, what are these stones? Sort of pulling from the language of the story of the Seder and Pesach. Then, vodatem et b'nechem le'mor, you will tell them that these stones, the message of these stones are, is Bayabasha Avar Israel Tayarden Hazeh, Ashovish Shemot Alokechem et Meha Yarden Mipnechem Ad Obrechem. God brought us across the Yarden on dry land and dried it out before you, as he had done to the Yamsuf, as he has done to the Red Sea beforehand, Kashir Asar Shem Alokechem Le Yamsuf Ashovish Mipnenu Ad Obrenu. And the notion that these stones present a kind of eternal monument to the crossing of the Yarden. And it's an odd observation, but that essentially, why do I need a monument to the mechanism or the means by which we cross the Yarden? In fact, we didn't have such a monument at Kriyat Yamsuf. We didn't make a monument of 12 stones to how we escaped or how we crossed the Yamsuf. Why is it necessary to the extent that there's even this instructions that these stones will create a point of question so that your children tomorrow will ask you, what are these stones? You'll tell them they represent the story of crossing of the Yarden. It's a mystery, right? Why is it necessary to create such a message? And one of the things that we concluded without really proving, but that's where we sort of left off for today, is that it seems, and it's sort of self-evident from the fact that there are 12 and they represent and they're created by the heads of each tribe, that somehow the crossing of the Yarden and the question of the unity of the Jewish people of the 12 tribes are at odds with each other. And we need the 12 stones to say, we are a unified nation of Israel of 12 tribes, and that God brought us into the land of Israel by crossing the Yarden. Meaning, what's the variable that's missing? The variable that's missing is that there are 2.5 tribes on the east bank of the Jordan River and 9.5 tribes on the west bank of the Jordan River. And so the Jordan creates a kind of natural boundary or barrier between the two sets of tribes. So how do you convey the message that crossing the Yarden did not split the people apart? Is you take 12 stones and you build them into a monument representing the 12 tribes of Israel on the banks of the Jordan River, saying God brought us over, God dried the river out, he brought us into the land of Israel, but not because we're separated from the 2.5 tribes of the east, on the east side, but rather we're one people, one nation, 12 stones, 12 tribes. That would be a simple explanation. The extent to which this message was critical and necessary, we don't really see here, but we do see in the story of Sefer Yoshua. In other words, the notion that the Jordan River created a risk for the tribes of Israel and for the unity of the tribes was something that Yoshua was keenly aware of. Remember how the whole story of the 2.5 tribes started. 2.5 tribes wanted to stay on the east side. Moshe got angry at them. He accused them of the sin of the spies, 2.0. And they said, no, we'll go, we'll defend, we'll fight, we'll be part of the war. Is it possible that your brothers are going to go to war and you're going to sit it out on the east side of the yard? And they said, no, we're going to go. Chalutzim, we'll go first. And they were, in fact, the leaders, the two, Reuben, Gad, and Menashe, they were the front lines of every battle. We will go and we will fight. We're one people. And so Yoshua takes on this task of recognizing that when you cross the Yarden, lest you have the perception or the risk of perceiving the Yarden as a border or boundary, Yoshua sets up this monument in Gilgal. All right. Was it successful? Was it necessary? So we're going to learn the story in Sefer Yeshua today that's not in sequence. We're going to jump out of sequence a little bit. We're going to jump to the end of the book because I want us to understand how 14, 15 years later, or 20 years later, this becomes such a critical issue. Somebody had a question?
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
I'm assuming at this point that the 2.5 tribes did not cross the Jordan except for the people who were going to be the soldiers, the women.
I'm only talking about the war. I'm only talking about the soldiers. That's essentially the equivalent. The women and children stay behind, but we're talking about the fact that they're crossing over the Jordan for the purpose of fighting the battle against the Canaan. The fact that the 2.5 tribes came and they stayed for 14 years, that's really their contribution and their role. And so the messaging was that we're one people. Right. That's the context. But you're right. The women and children stayed behind. All right. So we're going to jump forward. How many years we're jumping forward? We're going to look at the story in chapter 22 of Sefer Yehoshua. How many years transpire between the beginning of the book and the end is debatable. Chazal suggests that there are a total of 14 years in the entire book, from 7 years of conquest and 7 years of settlement. It's a debatable argument. The Mefarshim struggle with the question of the timeline, but it's certainly not more than, if it's not 14, if it's a little bit longer than 14, it's maybe 20, right? But it's the end of this. Yeshua is, remember, he's 40, he's part of the story of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, he's Moshe's Talmud, comes into the land of Israel, he dies at the age of 110, so there's a, it's not that far ahead of where we're at. So we're going to jump to chapter 22. Chapter 22, just to put in perspective, it's more or less the end of the story. The land is more or less conquered, not completely, but more or less. This is sort of a map of the tribes and where they're located. And they are, the land is more or less conquered. There's some parts of the east, of the west, the coastal plain that hasn't yet been conquered. There are areas that haven't been conquered. We'll talk about that in much greater detail at a later context. But at this point, Yeshua calls Reuven, Gad, and Menashe over, and he says to them, "Vayomer alehem, atem shmartem et kol asher tzivah etchem Moshe v'ad Hashem, v'tishmu b'koli l'kol asher tziviti etchem." Says, you guys have been here for the whole time, for all these 20 years. They've been rotation, but essentially 14 years, they've been part of the story of the conquest and the settlement of the land of Israel. Lo azavtem et achichem ze yamim rabim. You didn't abandon your brothers these many years. Ad hayom hazeh ushmartem et mishmeret mitzvat Hashem elokechem. You kept the charge that God commanded you. Vatanyach Hashem elokechem al achichem kasher diber lehem. Now God has given your brethren, the other tribes, rest, meaning they've more or less settled in their land. So I'm letting you go. You are hereby absolved of any further obligation under the oath you took to with Moshe. You are now free to go back to your land, that God gave you on the other side of the Jordan. And then Yeshua gives them a warning. Small warning. I'm just telling you, you're going back to the other side of the Yarden. Keep the mitzvot. Keep the Torah that Moshe, God's servant, commanded you. To love God, to walk in His ways, to keep the commandments, to keep them. It kind of reads like Kriyat Shema. Right? The core theology of Jewish life. Vayivarchem Yeshua. Yeshua gave him a bracha. Vayishalachem. Sent them on their way. Vayelechu el olehem. And they went to their tents. So you understand. Reuven, Gad, half of Menashe. That's not a small group. I showed you the map before. Right? That's not a small group. That's the army of, right? The representative army. Unclear how many there were, because they were in a rotation every couple of months. whatever it is, 10, 20, 30,000 of them, Yeshua finally says, okay, you are absolved. ולחצי שבט המנשה נתן משה בבשן, ולחציו נתן ישוע עם אחיהם בעבר הירדן ימה, וגם כי שלחם ישוע לעולם ביברכם. The area, actually, I'm going to keep this map open. The area that was given to them was the area of the Reuven, Gad, and half of Menashe on the other side of the Yarden. ויאמר להם לאמור, okay, I'm going to skip the rest of the story. The rest of it is further instructions. Vayeshuva vayelchu b'nei Reuven u'b'nei Gad v'chatzi shevet ha'manasseh me'et b'nei Yisrael mishiloh. The Mishkan is already in Shiloh. Base camp is now in Shiloh. How he got to Shiloh, we'll see later in the story. But from Shiloh, Yehoshua instructs them to return home. Shiloh is in Eretz Canaan. Lalechet al Eretz Hagilad, al Eretz Achuzatam shenochazuba al pi Hashem yad Moshe. So they're going to the area of the Gilad. Gilad essentially is the area between the Yabok and north of the Yabok River, all the way up here. Menashe is part of the Gilad. There's part of Gad that's part of the Gilad. Ramot Gilad. This is the area that's sort of the heartland of the tribal territory of Reuven, Gad, and Menashe, all the way up to the Golan. Now watch what happens next. Vayavo el glilot ha-yarden, they come to the region of the Yarden, asher be'eretz Canaan, as they're about to cross over the land, the Jordan, from Eretz Canaan to the Gilad. ויבנו בני ראובן ובני גד וחצי שבט המנשה שם מזבח על הירדן, מזבח גדול למראה. The two and a half tribes build on the banks of the Jordan River an enormous altar. מזבח גדול למראה. Great, large altar to look at. Now, what's ambiguous here is where they build it. Glilot ha-Yarden be'eretz Canaan is the crossing area of the Yarden. Is it built on the east side of the Yarden or the west side of the Yarden? There's some discussion in the Mefarshim. I tend to think it's on the east side of the Yarden based on the next pasuk. Vayishmu v'nei Yisrael lemor hinei banu b'nei Reuven u'b'nei Gad v'chatzi shevet ha-Menashe. The tribes of Israel heard that Reuven, Gad, Menashe built an altar, El Mul Eretz Canaan, opposite the land of Canaan, which is why I think it's on the east side of the Yarden, even though most of the Mefarshim say otherwise, El Glilot Yarden, El Ever B'nei Yisrael, on the other side of B'nei Yisrael. How do you think they reacted? Altar? Why would you build an altar? Vayishmu b'nei Yisrael, when Israel, meaning the rest of the tribes, heard that Reuben, Gad, and Menashe built an altar on the banks of the Jordan River, I'm going to say on the east side, doesn't really matter, but the story makes a little bit more sense that way. Vayikalu kol adat b'nei Yisrael Shiloh la'alot aleihem latzava, they gathered together in Shiloh to go to war. You understand that we're now looking at the potential of the first civil war in Israel. Nine and a half tribes gathered together in Shiloh to go to war against the two and a half tribes on the east side of the Jordan for the audacity of building an altar. Altar, read, Mikdash, Mishkan, Tabernacle, right? Altar, read, alternative worship of God to the Mishkan that's in Shiloh, right? This is unacceptable. And they're ready to go to war. Who do they send to lead this delegation of a potential civil war? They send somebody who's quite well known for calming the waters and making sure that everybody stays cool-headed. They sent Pinchas. Yes, that was sarcastic. Vayishlachu b'nei Yisrael b'nei Reuven b'nei Gad v'chatzi shevet Menashe al eretz Gilad. It's Pinchas ben Elazar Kohen. They sent the chief zealot priest, Pinchas, to lead the delegation. And they sent with them 10 princes representing the 10 tribes. Remember, 9.5 means 10 tribes, right? Menashe has a representative on each side of the Jordan. So, Nasi Echad, Nasi Echad, Lebet Av, Lechol Matot Yisrael, Ve'ish Rosh Beit Avotam, Hema Lafei Yisrael, they each sent leaders of the tribes of Israel. They are now, all 10 tribes on the east side, on the west side, are going to meet the leadership of the tribes on the east side. Ve'avo l'bnei Reuven l'bnei Gad l'chatzi shevet Menashe el eretz Gilad v'yidabru itam lemor. And they start. Pinchas, together with the heads of the 10 tribes, and he starts. Now, classic diplomacy 101. First thing you do is ask why. But that's not what Pinchas does. This is classic Pinchas diplomacy, which is you shoot first and you ask questions later. And that's exactly what Pinchas does. Ko amru kol adat Hashem. Thus says the congregation of God. Ma ha'mal hazeh Hashem altem b'elokei Yisrael. What is this rebellion? What is this treachery that you have committed against God? Lashuv hayom echrei Hashem. One day, you're back in your land for one day, and you've already committed treason. Bivnotechem lachem mizbeach limrodchem hayom b'Hashem. That you build your own altar, you build your own temple, you build your own. This is trespass. This is rebellion. This is treachery. This is treason. And if that's not enough, Pinchas is, has a frame of reference to this kind of rebellion. Hame'at lanu et avon Peor. Remember the story of Baal Peor? Remember the tens of thousands of the people of Shimon who died because of the story of Cosby Batzur? Pinchas had to stand up and kill Cosby and etc. Right? That's where I Pinchas was sent here. We have not even recovered yet from the story of Baal Peor. But yeah, Nekev Badat Hashem, terrible plague. Vatem Tashuvu Yom Hashem, and today you're going to rebel against God. Vayatem Timrudu Yom Hashem Umachar Et Kol Adat Yisrael Yuktzof. You're going to rebel today. God will punish all of us. We can't let that happen. And so, no, I've got an army behind me, ready to go. And this is still Pinchas speaking. And he says to them, actually, I don't need the map right now. V'ach imtme, and listen to the argument. Imtme, maybe I do need the map. Imtmeya eretz achuzatchem. If your land you deem to be unclean, Tamei, because it's outside of the boundaries of the land of Israel. So then cross back over to the land of the inheritance of God. The land in which is Sheshachan Sham Mishkan Hashem, the land in which the Mishkan containing the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant is in that land. Ve'achazu b'tocheinu, and come back to the real land of Israel. Uvashem al timrodu, but do not rebel against God. V'yotanu al timrodu, and do not rebel against us. Bivnotechem lachem mizbeach, to build yourself an altar, an alternative temple. Mi baladei mizbeach Hashem elokeinu, besides the altar in the temple. Halo Achan ben Zerach, mal mal b'cherem. We're going to get to the story of Achan, but Achan is the story of the beginning of Sefer Yeshua, after the conquest of Jericho. He transgressed the cherem that Yeshua set on the city of Jericho. And the result was that we lost thousands in a war. And that was only when he was one person. You are going to trespass, create treason, build your own temple? Okay. Pinchas has finally finished speaking. And the people on the other side, Reuven, Gad, and Menashe, have been quietly listening to Pinchas. You know, sometimes you build up your own energy and your own anger and your own zealotry and your own, and you keep going and you keep going and you keep going. And finally, they don't even interrupt him. They just wait till he finishes. And then they said, V'anu b'nei Reuvenu b'nei Gad, v'chatzi shevet ha-Menashe. So Reuven, Gad, and Menashe answered, V'yidabru et roshei alfei Yisrael. And they spoke to the heads of the thousands of Israel, meaning there's a delegation of an army of people there, but they're also leaders of each tribe. Who are they not speaking to? Right? They don't address Pinchas. They don't respond to Pinchas because there's nothing to talk to there. He's already made up his mind. They've committed treason. So he turns to the leadership of the tribes and he says to them, they say to them, El Kel Elokim Hashem, Kel Elokim Hashem, Hu Yodea, V'Yisrael Yeda, Im B'Mered V'Im B'Mal B'Hashem Al Toshiyeno Yom Hazeh. They take an oath by God, living God, God of Israel. God knows if we acted in a manner that was rebellious or treacherous, then we will pay the price. We should build an altar to turn away from God? God forbid. You think we built this thing to be functional? To bring on it burnt offerings and meal offerings? To bring on its sacrifices of peace offerings? If that is what we've done, so let Hashem punish us. That has nothing to do with this, what we built. What we built had a different purpose altogether. Remember, it was an altar that was not designed by the specifications of the altar in the Mizbeach, in the Mishkan. This was an altar that, this was a Mizbeach that was much bigger. Gadol ma'od lemar'eh. So big that it was not functional. Why would you build such an altar on the banks of the Jordan River, one side or the other? So they explained. Im lo mida'agada midavar. We had a worry. We had an anxiety. We had a concern. Asinu etzot. What was the concern? Machar yomru v'nechem livaneinu lemor. We were concerned that a generation from now, two generations from now, your children would say to our children, you're not part of the people of Israel. You're not part of the nation of Israel. You're a different nation. You're a different tribe. As you can see, God created a border, a boundary, a border, the Jordan River, between you and us. And therefore, because there's a border, ein lachem chelek ba'Hashem. We were afraid your children said to our children, we, Reuven and Gad, are not part of the authentic children of Israel, and we have no share in the God of Israel. V'yishbitu b'nechem et b'neinu, and your children will destroy our children. L'vilti yirat Hashem. And make them not fear God. Meaning, what was the concern of Reuven and Gad? That a generation from now, your children are going to say the Jordan River is a natural boundary. The children of Israel, the people of Israel, we are in the land between the Jordan and the Mediterranean. And all the tribes that are on the east side of the Jordan, they're not really part of the authentic children of Israel. They're extra. They're second class. Which is precisely what Pinchas said to them. The irony is, that's exactly what Pinchas said. Pinchas said to them, if the land that God gave you is impure, so come back and come and settle in the real land of Israel. Come and settle in the land of Achuzat Hashem, the land in which God is the present, the land of the Mishkan in Shiloh. He was a Kohen in Shiloh. Right? That was exactly what Pinchas said. He doesn't have to wait a generation to see the truth in the words of Reuven and Gad. Just see it in Pinchas' attitude. So therefore, they went on and said, "Vanomer." So we said, Naseh lanu livnot et hamizbeach. We will build the altar. Meaning, lo le'ola v'lo le'zabach. We didn't build this for sacrificing. This is not an altar. If you build an altar not for the purpose of sacrifices, what have you built?
Monument.
A monument. A mitzvah. A matzivah. You've built a monument. Ki eduhu beneinu uvenechem. We've built it as a testimony, as a witness between us and you. Uven doroteinu achareinu, and between our next generations. La'avod et avodat Hashem lefanav. So that we will continue to serve God with our offerings, not on this altar, but in the Mishkan and Shiloh. So your children won't say to us tomorrow, you have no portion in God.
Don't they have to have an agreement between two? When you build something like that and it's like a witness, don't they have to have two sides to show that? Like a covenant or something?
It's not a brit.
I know, but it's a witness, so they have to
have
two sides.
What's the witness? They built a replica of the Mizbeach and the Mishkan to show that they saw the Mishkan, that is where their allegiance lies. The message, that's why I think it was built on the east side of the Yarden, not on the west side of the Yarden. The message was about belonging, about identity. It's not about a Brit. It's not a like Yaakov
But the text said Beniu Venechem. So if it says Venechem, then it means it has to be together.
It's not a brit, it's an aid. It's a testimony. It says to your children, we, the next generation, this is where our allegiance lies. You want to accuse us of not having allegiance to the God of Israel when not being part of the people of Israel? Know that our allegiance is to whoever the authentic original of this Mizbeach lives. God forbid that we should rebel against God. And to abandon God? To build a functioning Mizbech? That we should build an altar besides the one that's in Shiloh? We built a monument. A monument to testify that to our children and to our children after us, and maybe to Pinchas too, that we are part of the children of Israel, that we are part of the same nation as you, same tribes as you, and we serve the same God, and we come to the same Mishkan. This is not for Mizbeach, for offerings. This is to tell us, this is like a signpost that says, you want to go to the Mishkan, follow what the model of this Mishkan, it's like the yellow brick road, right? Follow the Mishkan, the Mizbeach that we built, it's pointing you in the right direction. So Pinchas now heard, Veishmat Pinchas HaKohen Nisiyah HaYedav Rashay Alfei Yisrael Asher Yito, all of the heads of the tribes and the generals that were with Pinchas, they heard the words of Reuben and Gad. Shedibru b'nei Reuven u'b'nei Gad u'b'nei Menasheh. Veidav b'nei, they liked it. They were satisfied. They heard a reasonable, rational explanation. Vayomer Pinchas ben Elazar HaKohen u'b'nei Reuven u'b'nei Gad u'b'nei Menasheh. And so he responded and he said, Hayom yadanu ki b'tochenu Hashem. Now we know that God is in our midst. Shelo ma'altem b'Hashem amal hazeh. You didn't trespass. You didn't commit treason. Az yitzaltem et b'nei Yisrael miyad Hashem. And you have saved Israel in the hands of God. And that was it. I find it fascinating that Pinchas doesn't even offer an apology. V'yashuv Pinchas Ben Elazar, Kohen Ben Nisim, Eit Bnei Reuven, Ben Eit Bnei Gad, Me Eretz Hagilad, El Eretz Kanan, El Bnei Yisrael, Yashivu Otam Davar. And they return, convey the message back to base camp. Vayitavadvar Bnei Yisrael. It is pleasing to them. Vayevaruchu Elokim Bnei Yisrael. They bless God. And Velo Amu La'alot Alehem Latzava L'Shechet Et Ha'aretz Asher Bnei Reuven Bnei Gad Yashrimba. And so they decide to disband the army and not go to war against Reuven, Gad, and Menashe, and that's a good thing, I think. Vayikru b'nei Reuvenu b'nei Gad la'mizbeach, ki edhu b'noteinu, ki Hashem will. They called this mizbeach, hang on a second, let me finish. They called this mizbeach a testimony, an aid, that we are associated with the God of the Jewish people and not some alternative God. The Mizbeach and the Mishkan had a certain structure, had a certain style, had a certain look. They built a replica so that they could say for generations to come, we were there, we were in the Mishkan. That's our association. This monument is part of that story. Okay. I ask a simple question. Where did they get this idea from? Where did they come up with the idea that they're going to, in order to define themselves, to identify themselves as belonging to the tribes, to the nation that's on the other side of the Yarden, that the Yarden's not a boundary, that's not a separation between two different nations, where did they get the idea that the way to do that is to take stones and build a Mizbeach? So here's my conjecture. I have no proof to what I'm going to suggest to you. I have no way of proving it whatsoever. But my guess is, my intuition is that this Mizbeach was built out of 12 stones. It's definitely built out of stones, multiple. I suspect it was built out of 12. Why? Because I think that what they were doing was exactly what Yehoshua did when he crossed the Yarden. The very purpose of Yehoshua's monument in Gilgal was exactly the same message. 12 stones representing 12 tribes. That the Jordan is not a boundary between us. The 9.5 tribes on the west side of the net and the 2.5 tribes on the east side are all part of one people. That was exactly why he built a monument. So the people, so the 2.5 tribes, when they crossed back over the Jordan, they did exactly what Yeshua did in the first go around. They built a monument, except this one had an additional message, which is they wanted to show their allegiance to the God of the Jewish people, not just to the nation of Israel. And so they built those stones into the form of a Mizbeach, because a Mizbeach is built out of multiple stones. But I suspect that the reason they built it was exactly the same as the initial message of Yehoshua in his stones, namely, that the Jordan River posed a challenge for Israel. We have tribes on both sides, and it's very easy for them to turn and say, you know what, we're a different tribe, we're a different people, we're on the east side of the Jordan is our boundary, Jordan's our border, and you're part of a different nation. The danger was there. Yehoshua tried to address the danger, and Reuven, Gad, and Menashe felt that danger. They felt it at the edge of Pinchas' sword. His gun was pointed at their heads. And they had to express themselves in terms that Pinchas understood. It was exactly the same terms that Yeshua had been doing when Yeshua crossed the Yarden initially. I'm going to stop this part of the story here. I will tell you one postscript, however. And that is that we're not done with the question of the Jordan River serving as, actually, I'm going to stop sharing for a second. We're not done with the question of the Jordan River serving as the boundary or a potential barrier between the two halves of the tribes of Israel. Because over the course of the remaining story of Tanakh, we're going to find many times, unfortunately, where this same issue rears its head. There in the Book of Shoftim, there are two civil wars, if you will, besides the story of Pelegish Begivah. Right? There is the story of Gidon, who fights against a set of tribes, and there's the story of Yiftach, who fights against a set of tribes. In both cases, the fight is across the boundary of the Jordan River. Yiftach, who comes from the east side, who fights against the tribes of Ephraim on the west side. Gidon, who comes from the west side, who fights against Phanuel and Sukkot on the east side. Later in history, in the Book of Malachim, in the Book of Kings, there's a series of internal rebellions and assassinations in the kingdom of Israel. Every one of them crosses the boundary of the Jordan River. somebody from the west side who kills the king from the east side, somebody from the east side who kills the king from the west side. The story of the split of the tribes of Israel becomes a source of tension for the rest of Tanakh history. And so Yehoshua correctly identified that challenge from the very moment they stepped across the Jordan River. And we see a beginning of it in the story of Pinchas. Addressed, resolved, peacefully, this time around. Unfortunately, not the last time. But this is the story of the Jordan River and the challenges we had throughout history. We're not going to go through it now because I want to at least read the next chapter. But this is where the Jordan River, the fact that we had tribes on each side, created for us a natural, intuitive sense of being divided into two nations. And that was never a good thing for us. I'm going to stop here for a moment, take a pause for some questions. I think Brian had a question. I see his hand raised. And then we'll come back to it. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks, Rabbi. I'm a bit confused. Last class, you explained in detail the difference between a Mizbeach and a Matseva.
Right.
Now it refers to the building a Mizbeach, and you've just told us it's really a Matseva.
Right. So
isn't that confusing?
Yes. So without getting into, I don't want to take too much time on this one because it's off topic a little bit, but generally speaking, we identify a Matseva as a single stone monument and a Mizbeach upon which you can bring sacrifices as a multiple stone structure. What you may not do in Tanakh ever, what you're not allowed to do, is bring korbanot on a single stone matzibah. Why that's the case is a whole theology and philosophy, but that's a fact. However, it's entirely possible to build a monument out of multiple stones. It's the other way around that's prohibited. You can't take a single stone and make it into a mizbeach. But you could take multiple stones and call it whatever you want, as long as you're not making an alternative to the mizbeach in the mikdash. For example, Moshe takes 12 stones and he establishes 12 matzivot and the mizbeach, the foot of Mount Sinai. So you sense that, right, if you could take those 12 stones and put them together, you'd have you would have a mizbeach. Another example would be Yoshua stones in Gilgal, which are also a testimony. The question is, what's the definition of a matzivah that's a prohibited issue? If it's part of a sacrificial service, it's a problem. But you could build stones into monuments. These 12 stones that Yeshua built, they were not a mizbeach, they were not really technically a matzivah in the sense of a mechanism for bringing offerings. They were a monument. They were they created a message. Well, that's exactly what B'nai Gad and Reuven did as well. They built a structure that conveyed a message. It wasn't a functional structure. It was a symbolic structure. In their case, they made the mistake, if you can call it that, of making it look like the Mizbeach of the Mishkan. That
was misinterpreted.
Yeah. Right? That set everybody off into until finally the art of diplomacy can be learned from this chapter, what to do and what not to do. And if you want a peaceful resolution, the first thing you have to learn is not to send Pinchas. After that, you have a chance. All right. Any other questions on this piece of the story? All right. Then I'm not sure how much of chapter 4 and 5 we're going to get to. So chapter 5, I mean. So we're going to read it and see how far we go. The next unit of our discussion, which is the... Let's go back to sharing screen. All right. Which brings us to chapter 5. So The first verse we actually looked at already. That's one of the additional explanations as to why it was important to cross the Yarden in such a dramatic fashion, in order to reset the sense of dread and trepidation that existed after Kriyat Yamsuf, that was lost in the story of the Battle of Amalek and other battles in the 38 years in the desert. Now we've sort of recreated that moment of Kriyat Yamsuf and the Mogu Koyosh V'Knan, the hearts of the Knanites recognizing the power of the God of Israel, and all of the kings and the Amorites of the on the west side of the Jordan, and all of the Canaanites of the sea, they heard how God dried the waters of the Yarden, the hearts melted, they were afraid, and this set the stage for the beginning of what will come next, is the story of the conquest of Israel. At that time, so now they've all crossed over. Right? To put it in perspective, they've all crossed over, and if you remember, the date is the 10th of Nisan. Yeshua, make knives, flint out of stone. Veshuv mol et bnei Yisrael shinit. You're going to need to recircumcise the entire population of the children of Israel. Vayasdol Yeshua chavot zurim. So Yeshua did so. He made knives. Vayamol et bnei Yisrael el givat aralot, and he circumcised all of Israel at what was known then or called the hill of the Orla or givat aralot. Now, you can ask the obvious question, why is it necessary to re-circumcise Israel? Were they not already circumcised? And the answer is they were not. This is why it was important for Yeshua to have to re-circumcise the population of Israel. The generation that left Egypt, they were circumcised. And that's a conversation we're going to have. Where and when did they circumcise the generation that left Egypt? Because it doesn't say anywhere in Chumash that they were re-circumcised. But the text says that that is in fact the case, that they were all given a brit. Kimulim ayu kol ha'am hayotzim. The people who left Egypt were all circumcised. Whereas, kol ha'am hayilodim b'midbar, b'derech b'tzeitam b'mitzrayim, lo malu. But the generation that were born in the desert, this next generation, as they come into the land of Israel, this next generation born in the desert, they were not circumcised. So ask yourself the obvious question, which is, why not? Right? The mitzvah of Brit Milah is now in force again after Yetziat Mitzrayim, together with all the other mitzvot of the Torah, why were they not circumcised? That's a question we're going to have to address. For 40 years they walked in the desert. Ad tom kol ha'goyan shem mechama yotzim mitzrayim, till the entire generation that left Egypt died out, because they were rebellious. Asher lo shamu b'kol Hashem, they didn't listen to God. Asher nishba Hashem lem levuti harotam et ha'aretz, asher nishba Hashem lavotam letet lanu eretz avat chalav u'dvash. God took an oath not to allow them to come into the land. Ved b'nehem hekim tachtam, they raised their children in their stead. Otam mal Yeshua, they were the generation that needed to be circumcised, and they were the ones that Yeshua circumcised. For they were uncircumcised. They did not perform Brit Milah in the desert. When it came to pass, when the entire nation of Israel was once again circumcised, they dwelt in the camp until they were healed. Hayom galoti et chirpat Mitzrayim mealechem. Today I have rolled away the shame of Egypt from upon you. Vayikra shem hamakom hu Gilgal ad hayom hazeh, and that's why they named the place Gilgal, from the play on the words galoti, to roll away the shame of Egypt. Vayachanu bnei Yisrael al Gilgal, and so they encamped at Gilgal. Now, before I read the next psukim, remember, what date did they cross the Yarden? The 10th of Nisan. 11th of Nisan, let's say, the next day, Yeshua embarks on a national circumcision effort, which is really quite amazing, because if you think about what happened to the story of Shechem, within the 3 days that they were circumcised, Reuven and Shimon and Levi went and attacked the entire city. Here you have an entire nation that is poised for war. The nations of Canaan know that they are coming to take their land back, and they weaken themselves nationally by circumcising the entire army. How easy would it have been for the nations of Canaan to use that moment to attack?
Also, it was Erev Pesach, no?
So what, well, we're going to get to Erev Pesach in a second. Right now it's the 11th of Nisan, correct? But it's just an observation that they're sitting on the edge of, they're inside the land of Israel already, and the nations of Canaan know they're coming to claim their land. And they take a 3-day hiatus, they circumcise the entire nation, which is really quite an extraordinary moment. But they cross the Yarden on the 10th. According to most traditions, it takes 3 days to heal from circumcision. That was certainly the story by Abraham. There's certainly the story by Shechem. So if they circumcised on the 11th, 12th, and 13th, then what's the next day? Erev Pesach, the 14th. And that's exactly what comes next. They went from Mila to Pesach, because that's exactly what you do. You go from Mila to Pesach, 3 days in between, from the 10th to the 14th. Remember, the chronology is really remarkable, because remember the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim, they also did something on the 10th and before Pesach. What did they do on the 10th before Pesach? The 10th of Nisan?
Got the sheep.
They took the sheep and tied it to the doorpost, to the bedpost. And nobody's quite clear or sure why they needed 4 days from the 10th to the 14th to prepare the sheep. Right? Why don't they just take the sheep at Erev Pesach? So there's all kinds of midrashim about it. But some of the mafreshim suggest that it's because, and here we see the moment, right, in the course of the 40 years, in the course of the hundreds of years of Shibud Mitzrayim, in the course of the hundreds of years of slavery in Egypt, they had given up on Bris Milah. And the Egyptians were not circumcised, so they were also not circumcised. But the Pasuk is very clear, and it's in Shemot Perek Yud Bet. It says, in the context of the Korban Pesach, the Pasuk says, Moshe would instruct Bnei Yisrael, this is the story of the Pesach, you have to eat it in the house. You can't take it out of the house. Right? This is the story of the Korban Pesach. But in this context, if a sojourner, a stranger, a ger, comes to, and he wants to participate in the Korban Pesach, first, he has to be circumcised, because kol arel lo yochabo, circumcision is a prerequisite for Korban Pesach. Korban Pesach and Brit Milah are interconnected. We're going to talk about that next week at length, but they are the only two mitzvot where one is a prerequisite for the other. A nation that is uncircumcised cannot fulfill the mitzvah of Korban Pesach.
Does that mean that they didn't celebrate Pesach during the wandering in the desert?
Oh, excellent question. I'm going to come to that in a second. But a generation, in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Korban Pesach in Mitzrayim, they had to be circumcised. So the most of the Mefarshim suggest, and the Midrashim certainly suggest, that that 4 days, 3 days really, from the 11th to the 13th, was designed for the mitzvah of Korban Pesach, a mitzvah of Brit Milah. That's where they fulfilled the mitzvah of Brit Milah, because Kol Arel Lo Yochama, they couldn't eat the Korban Pesach without being circumcised. That's why they prepared the Pesach on the 10th, but they're going to eat it on the 14th. And in between, you have the 3 days for Brit Milah. It's really an extraordinary moment. And you have the exact same pattern here, only here it's spelled out explicitly. Once they circumcise themselves, then, and you remove the shame of Egypt, Galut Yechepat Mitzrayim, whatever that means, we'll talk about next week, then they could participate in the Korban Pesach. And the dates are exactly the same. They crossed the Yarden on the 10th, just like they took the Korban Pesach on the 10th, and 3 days for Brit Milah, here it's explicit, in the case of Mitzrayim, it's implied, and then they could eat the Korban Pesach. Not only could they eat the Korban Pesach, but something else happens once you bring the Korban Pesach. What mitzvah, what happens the next day after the Korban Pesach? The mitzvah of the Omer. And you can eat of the new produce of the land after the bringing of the Omer. Vayochlu mi'avod ha'aretz mi'mocharat ha'pesach matzot v'kalui be'etzem ha'yom hazeh. From the day after Pesach, they could now eat of the produce of the land. Veishbot haman mimachwat. And therefore the man, which had been there for 40 years, the moment they could now partake of the food, the produce of the land of Israel, the man stopped. There's a whole discussion about it takes a year to grow crops. But anyway, but for, at least conceptually, veishbot haman mimachwat beochlam me'avur haaretz. The moment they could eat of the produce of the land, the man stops. So there are really three stories in this chapter. There's Brit Milah, that is necessary because even though, and this is explicit in the text, even though Bnei Yisrael who left Egypt were circumcised, they didn't circumcise themselves during the 40 years of the desert, wandering, the next generation, and so they needed a national Brit Milah before they could participate in the Korban Pesach. And so they have Milah, they have Pesach, and they have the Omer, or they have the cessation of the man. So we're going to have to kind of navigate through all three of these pieces of this parak, including the question that that you asked, which is, so what do they do for the 40 years in the desert? Did they have a Korban Pesach or didn't they? They were circumcised when they left Egypt. So did they have Korban Pesach all those years? Or if they didn't circumcise themselves, the next generation, did some who were circumcised have the Korban Pesach and those who were not circumcised didn't have the Korban Pesach? What did they do over those 40 years? So that, Bezrat Hashem, is where we will start next week. We will break, I'll bring in this. There's a source page, but I didn't get to it today because it starts with this question about Brit Milah in the desert and Korban Pesach in the desert. So I will hold that, and we will start with that next week. All right. So I will stop here. If there are any questions, I'm happy to entertain them.
I think it's very strange that, you know, if they went, the 2.5 tribes, if they were, you know, like fighting with them for years and years, I don't know, I forget how many years you said, but 13, 14, I don't know how many years it took them to take over. And then they're still doubting them. You know, why does that happen? And that's one thing. The second thing is the repeating of that key word, you know, like that Mila Mancha, Beni, Uvenotochem, or whatever, that means like, you know, two have to be there. So I don't understand. So maybe the problem was that they did it on their own and they didn't include, and they should have, you know, if they made that kind of a thing as a witness, maybe they should have had the two parts, and maybe that was their problem.
It's possible. I think it's more about trying to repeat what Yeshua had done. Yeshua started by creating a monument of 12 stones. They were trying to follow up that same idea on the other side of the Yarden, because the 12 stones that Yeshua had set up, he put in Gilgal, and they wanted something. I suspect strongly it's on the east side of the Yarden. There's a machloket and a mafarshim, but that's my intuition. And so they didn't just take 12 stones to replicate Yeshua's piece. They were already at a different stage. For 20 years later, there's a mishkan and there's a mizbeach and it's functioning. And so they took another step, which is to build a monument that looks like the mizbeach in Shiloh. Whether they were right or wrong is less my issue as much as how it was interpreted. And that's why I really wanted to see the connection. It was certainly interpreted as from both sides. The B'nai Yisrael interpreted it as you're building your own Mizbeach. B'nai Reuben and God interpreted their intentions were to show that they're part of the same people. So what you sense from it is how dangerous it was for there to be a physical separation between the two sets of tribes, and that plays out in the course of biblical history. That yeah. Boundary was very dangerous, unfortunately.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks.
Any other questions?
Yeah. I was always under the impression that B'nai Israel in Egypt were circumcised, and they're taking the lamb on the 10th as a sign of spiritual, you know, uprising. And, when Bat Paro finds Moshe and one can say, oh, there's a baby in the river, so it must be, but you also look at the baby and say, ah, you know, it's like kids circumcised, so it's gotta be that this was, you know,
like everything else in Mitzrayim.
This is the practice of B'nai Israel that they brought with them from Eretz Canaan.
And that's true. So we'll look at the source next week. There's a very powerful medrash that suggests that, in fact, at some point or another, part of their effort to assimilate into Canaanite, into Egyptian world and Egyptian culture early is the abandoning the mitzvah of Brit Milah. They come down circumcised, and then within a generation or two, they abandon it in an attempt to fit in. And that Chazal said very clearly. And in fact, there's even a medrash. I'm kind of giving you punchlines from next week, but I'll call them teasers. There's even a medrash that they mix the blood of Brit Milah and the blood of Korban Pesach, and they put them both on the doorpost. It's a fascinating story. But the fact that, but I think the reason why Chazal kind of navigated the connection between them is based on the psukim here in Yeshua. Psukim here in Yeshua certainly imply that mulim hayu, they were circumcised, but at the same time they were assimilated. So how could they be assimilated and circumcised, and therefore they must have gone back and forth? So there's a whole discussion. We'll get to it all. That's exactly what we're going to explore next week.
There's a lot of people who are pretty assimilated today, but they, by and large, they're circumcised.
Yeah, that's because we live in a post, in a world in which this is all part of our history. Because we learned, it's some lessons from history we've learned. But we'll talk about that. We'll get to it all.
Thank you very much.
Right. My pleasure. It's a pleasure to see everybody. And we will, Bezat Hashem, see you all next week.
Thank you very much. That was excellent. Thank you.